The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Hewitt here on a Holy Thursday, Maundy Thursday, many Christians call it. Catholics refer to it as Holy Thursday. Blessed one to you if you are observing the day. Tomorrow is Good Friday, and I will be replaying in the first 2 hours of my show a wonderful interview with the now retired Archbishop of the Diocese of Philadelphia, Archbishop Charles Shep Pugh, about his book, Things Worth Dying For, because it is the day that Christians recall the crucifixion of Christ. Friday's here, Sunday's coming. Easter is its own celebration. We'll hear from Tarzan and Joe about that a little bit later. I also want to let you know that a good friend of mine passed away in Ohio yesterday, and I will be going off to the funeral, driving up there on short notice whenever it's announced. So I may not be here Monday. I don't know. We'll see. Just letting you know ahead of time. Yesterday, Joe Lieberman passed away at the age of 82, complications from a fall. The senator was a good friend of the show, appeared on it frequently, just a wonderful human being. Wrong about most political votes, but an exemplar of how one conducts public life. Britt Hume was on last night with Brett Baer on Fox and delivered this remembrance of Joe Lieberman, cut number 14.
Joe Lieberman was, I noticed that it was noted that he loved his state. Well, his state loved him, and certainly it had to. It isn't easy to get elected to a body as an independent, but he did that in Connecticut, and he was beloved there. And, you know, won a number of state offices before he was elected to the Senate. He was very much a true moderate, a centrist, always on the lookout for ways to work with the other party. That sets him apart today. And, of course, he's been active since he's been out of office. As has been noted, he was involved in the No Labels movement, which a lot of Democrats didn't approve of, and some Republicans didn't either. He was a very hard man to dislike. He was an exceptionally nice man, gentle in his manner, friendly in his demeanor, always with a smile. He knew many members of the press and always was able to call them by name. People liked him, and, well, they should have, in my view. I always thought very highly of Joe Lieberman, and I'm very saddened to hear he died. It seemed awfully sudden. I guess it was from the after effects of a fall. Anyway, my condolences to all and his family. He will certainly be missed.
Very, very much so. I listened to the commentary podcast yesterday, and John Podhoretz was talking about his long-term friendship with Joe Lieberman, and obviously a big blow to his friends and his family, and he will be missed. I will echo what John said online. The Dick Cheney-Joe Lieberman debate in the year 2000 was the most substantive and best presidential and vice presidential debate ever, excluding none. Two of them sitting at a table with one moderator talking to each other. It was funny. It was wise. It was on target. It's long ago and far away in a galaxy not our own. All right. The galaxy of our own, I'm looking at a Telegraph story this morning. Insurers face a record $3 billion bill from the Baltimore Bridge collapse. $3 billion. Oh, my goodness. It will take forever to get it rebuilt, by the way, because the federal government, Pete Buttigieg is involved. Here's Pete Buttigieg yesterday, cut number 4.
Talk on inflation.
Too soon to say. I think, this is definitely a different ballpark from what we saw with the West Coast issues in 2021. But that's part of what we hope to gather more data on soon. I will say, a lot of the disinflation that we've seen has been a result of the work that the president led to improve and smooth out our...
All right, let's stop for a moment. The question is, will this lead to inflation? The answer is yes, because Baltimore was a major port of entry for cars being imported in the United States. Fewer cars means more dollars chasing fewer cars means inflation. Pete doesn't get that. Then they asked him, how long is this going to take? Cut number five.
In the case of the bridge is that the original bridge took 5 years to construct. That does not necessarily mean it will take 5 years to replace, but that tells you what went into that original structure going up. Again, we need to get a sense of the conditions of the parts that...
Why can't an elected or an appointed official say, I have no idea, but I'll let you know as soon as we get an estimate. Josh Shapiro was able to walk out and say, we're going to reopen the interstate in 2 months or whatever he said. He got it done. That's not this. There's a major long bridge, the 695, and it's going to take a long time, and nobody knows because there are many more requirements now than it was when it was opened in 1958. Pete Buttigieg said this as well, cut number six.
My intention is to get this first request processed immediately and start those dollars flowing. Even in these earliest days, there are expenses that can be associated with the design, planning, engineering, other things that need to go into getting that bridge restored. And we will make sure, as the president has directed, that financing and administrative issues are not a barrier to getting that done quickly.
I have to say, I am not reassured that Pete Buttigieg is in charge of opening up the 695. Now, I don't use it often. I have used it in the past. I don't use it often. Normally, I'm going around Baltimore, not through it. But the time that people do use it is in the middle of the night. So six people are dead. It could have been just a whole lot worse. It's very expensive. I don't know about you, but when you vote in November, remember, you're not electing one. You're electing 3,000 people. And one of those 3,000 people will be the Secretary of Transportation. And it's currently the incompetent Pete Buttigieg. And you get to choose. Would you rather have a competent person or the mayor of South Bend trying to get your bridge rebuilt? I'd also vote for Larry Hogan for senator if I was in Maryland in order to get that done. I went on with Martha McCollum yesterday to talk about Ron McDaniel. Cut number 12.
Hugh, let me go to you on this. So Cesar Conde said no newsroom can succeed unless it is cohesive and aligned. Now, they do have some Republican contributors there, but apparently she was not in line with where how they want those people to sound, Hewitt.
Well, I am a former NBC employee, and I'm a friend of Ron. I like to disclose that. And I know how tricky contracts are, and I think Cesar did his best with a very bad set of circumstances, but they did Ronna very bad. She is a fine Republican. She is not an election denier. She has never denied the election. She is pro-Trump. If you look up and down MSNBC, you will not find one pro-Donald Trump voice. You will not find one pro-Donald Trump panelist on Meet the Press. You will not find one pro-Trump anyone anywhere in Comcast or NBC anymore. And it's going to stay that way. I think Brian Roberts, who runs Comcast, has got to be asking, do I really want to tell half of the country we don't want their business? Because that's what they did.
That's what they did. Comcast owns NBC and Comcast owns Xfinity. Cut the cord. Comcast does not like you, Trump supporters. There is not one Trump supporter on NBC. There is not one. There is not one Trump supporter on MSNBC. He got 74 million votes. 74 million votes in 2020. He was elected in 2016. And a, quote, news organization does not have and cannot allow one Republican on, Ron McDaniel. They got a lot of excuses about, oh, she's an election denier. No, she's not. She did what the RNC did, what the DNC did in 2000 and 2004 and 2016, which is look under every possible desk for votes. She has not been indicted either by Jack Smith or by Fannie Willis, which tells you in those remarkably stretched, and I believe beyond reasonable prosecutions, that they could not, in their wildest imagination, indict Ronna McDaniel because she didn't do anything wrong. All right, she's not an election denier. And so what Comcast has said, what Brian Roberts, the CEO of Comcast, and Cesar Conde, who is the CEO and president of NBC Universal, have allowed to happen is the exile of Republicans. And I don't think any Republican should go on their network, period. Ever done. And they conned us on the debates. By us, I say me. I was part of that, part of the presentation. I said, sure, I'll work with them. I think Lester and Kristen can be fair. And it was a very fair debate. It was a very good debate. It proved the point that the old NBC could be trusted. But But then MSNBC has apparently taken over the brains and the bodies of everyone at NBC News and destroyed their reputation. I said this as well to Martha McCollum. Cut 13.
I just want to get a final thought from Hugh on this. Hugh, you know, I remember nights of watching election coverage and looking at what was going on across the networks, right? So if Trump were to win, it looks like it's going to be a very close election in 2024. I can imagine that once again, you're just going to have these shocked faces across the board. And to which I would only say, well, maybe if you had some people on there who talked about what's actually going on in the country and the, you know, 50-50 split and what they're saying and talking about, you might not be so caught on your heels on this reality.
I do not know who is going to keep NBC informed of what normal people think, because Ronna McDaniel's about as normal as they come. Yep. She's a Michigan mom. She's been in that job for 7 years. She represents the Republican Party. NBC and Comcast does not touch our viewership, period.
Now that's it. They don't want you to watch, don't watch. They don't want you represented, don't watch. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway, joined by Michael Whatley, the new chairman of the Republican National Committee. Hi, Michael. Welcome. How are you?
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Hugh. We're doing really well. It's a great day to be a Republican, I'll say that.
It is. But I am worried about, let's get my worries out of the way. You are a Golden Domer. Now, I know you went to UNC and Wake Forest, but you are a Golden Domer. And I checked the schedule. Notre Dame is playing at Navy on October 26th. And then the Seminoles of Florida State are coming in to South Bend on November 9th. Will you give us your full and undivided attention during the football season?
You know, it'll be hard, but I think that we're going to have a lot going on. We've got 32 weeks to stay focused, and then the time for the national championship game, we'll be able to return to football.
No, you know, Golden Domers are always the same. They talk national championship because they saw one like 20 years ago. Michael, let me start with the obvious thing. You were a part of the debate selection process, and you were general counsel. Do you have any explanation for what NBC did to Ronna McDaniel over the weekend?
It is an absolutely appalling double standard. You know, you think about Jen Psaki walking straight out of the White House over to the MSNBC studio. They had absolutely no heartburn whatsoever with that. You've got folks like George Stephanopoulos. You've got folks like Chuck Todd, Democrats that have been hired for years on all these networks. And as soon as you have one Republican step on stage, there's an absolutely national meltdown. It really is an appalling double standard.
In 2014, Ronna's predecessor, Reince Priebus, boycotted MSNBC, called on all GOP elected officials to boycott MSNBC because they had done an outrageous tweet. And, you know, Phil Griffin apologized because that was major shutdown time. Do you think, will you be asking other Republican elected officials and appointed officials to not appear on NBC or talk to NBC because and unless and until they apologize to Ronna?
No, look, I think we want to be able to use every single available outlet to get our message out to the American people. But people are not going to go on a network that they can't trust, that they know they won't be treated fairly. So I think you're going to see that across the board. We know that we need to find alternative ways to talk to the American voters. We can't just stay still. We can't just stop. We have to be able to communicate. You know, one of the great things about 2016 was Donald Trump was able to capture social media and use it effectively to go talk directly to the voters. That's why we've got shows just like yours. That's why we've got shows across a number of different platforms, including Twitter and X, where we are seeing shows that are popping up right now as ways for us to be able to get out to the American voters the information that they need to make informed decisions.
Now, Michael, you were the general counsel before you became the chairman, and therefore you would have gone over the contract with NBC and been in the negotiations with NBC. I believe you were in the room when I presented with Salem and CNN, and I believe you lawyered everything. My question, at any time during this whole process, did anyone refer to Ronna McDaniel at NBC as an election denier, a mobster, or a pickpocket?
Not at all. And again, I think it just goes kind of back to what we're seeing on air right now is the double standard that they are showing. When it was time for them to try and work with us on business decisions, that's great. But as soon as she steps on air, We see people that came out of Democratic operations melting down over the fact that they were trying to be fair, maybe. But the double standard we're seeing today is really unfortunate.
Now, Comcast owns NBC. Comcast is run by Brian Roberts. Cesar Conde runs NBC Universal. Rebecca runs NBC News. And, of course, Carrie Budoff-Brown was in charge. Have any of those four people called you, Michael Whatley, to apologize for what went on, the mugging and the election denier lies? And I mean, she was just defamed and relentlessly defamed for 24/7 in the most hostile workplace I've ever seen.
No, I've not had any outreach from any of them. And I don't really expect any outreach that's going to come to them. Again, we are focused right now on making sure that we are communicating with American families why Republicans are better. And every voter understands today that they were better off with Donald Trump in the White House than they are today with Joe Biden. And that is going to drive those decisions that we're going to see come November. And so we're really, truly focusing on building our operations right now to get ready to get out the vote and protect the vote come November.
Well, I'm going to turn to some very nuts and bolts stuff in a second, but I want to close the loop on Rana. I think what NBC did is really one of the most disgusting things I've ever seen on TV. And I think they're doing it, and Noah Rothman agreed with me, in order to anathematize, to make real Trump supporters taboo. I think they're trying to punish anyone who has anything good to say about Donald Trump. What's the RNC going to do about that? Because it's going to intimidate people. They're going to be afraid. They're going to lose their jobs at the network. They're going to get mugged on reality TV and slandered and defamed. How do you guys deal with that?
We are going to go to every available outlet, every available platform, and we are going to communicate directly with the American voters. You know, the single most important statistic in all of politics is if you have a 5-minute conversation with an undecided voter, they are 6% more likely to vote and vote for your candidate. At the end of the day, we are going to win elections based on tableside conversations, based on conversations at work, based on conversations at church. We are going to make sure that we are using any and every available platform to put our message out there and demonstrate to the American people the amazing contrast that we have in front of us right now, where you see on the left, they want to weaken America. They want to weaken families. They do not want to have American economy in a great place. They don't want us to stand by our allies. When you look on the right, what you see is that we are going to have secure borders. We are going to have a strong national security posture, and we're going to have an economy that works for every American family. The contrast is so big. All we need to do is have people understand that they are better off under President Trump. They will be better off under President Trump, and they're going to go out and they're going to vote.
You know, I think the former president's going to win, and I'm going to vote for him. And I've always said that. I voted for him in 2016 and 2020. I'm just sick to death of the media because it's just, Michael, I don't know how you can do your job, but let's talk about going around them. How is the money situation at the Republican National Committee and the Trump reelect, or the I guess it is a reelect campaign. What's the money situation?
We are absolutely going to have the resources that we need to get our message out to every American voter from one end of the country to the other.
And will you be focused on the 7 swing states like a laser and deploying staff? And if so, when do they start to arrive?
We have already started deploying teams out there. We've got political teams that are going to be out there, and their key job with our victory programs is going to be recruiting and training the volunteers that are going to make the phone calls, knock on the doors, and make sure that we are having those 5-minute conversations with the voters. We also have put out election integrity teams into a number of different states, and we're building that apparatus out there right now. These are going to be attorneys and political folks that are going to be recruiting and training attorneys and observers to be able to serve in any time that we're watching votes that are being cast, votes that are being counted. We want to make sure that we're in the room. So those investments have already started. And yes, we know that it's going to be 6-8 states that are going to be absolutely crucial for the presidential. We also know we're working with the senatorial committee that we've got a number of states like Montana and Ohio, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Nevada, where we've got races that we want to make sure that we're competing in. And then on the congressional side with my good friend Richard Hudson and the NRCC, we're working right now to make sure that we're going to have a functional majority in the House going forward.
I think Chairman Hudson's doing a great job. I know Steve Daines is doing a great job. And you name the big five. Those are the big five Senate races. I want to talk about something. I've been in this game for a long time. I'm older than you. But I learned from J.D. Vance after the last campaign why a hard dollar contribution to the RNC or the candidate is so much preferable to a super PAC contribution. You get the rate. You get the best rate on the card. I never figured that out. So what's the pitch to my audience for that they should contribute to the RNC as opposed to, you know, some group they see on TV?
Look, at the end of the day, when it comes to winning elections, it's about making sure that we are turning out the vote and that we are protecting the ballot. Those are the two main functions that the RNC has. We have merged our operations with the president's campaign already. We are working with a unified political front. We're working with a unified communications team. Our finance teams are working together, our digital teams, our data teams. Every single dollar that investors make with us is going to put lead on target in these key races. And we're working hand in glove with the Senate committee and the House committee. But at the end of the day, as a party, we are able to directly coordinate. Like you said, we get the best rate. We're going to be working directly with our candidates, coordinating with our candidates, and making sure every dollar is focused on winning in November.
Now, you and Rana and everyone at the RNC built Win Red, and it's really successful. Is that still the place to go?
That is absolutely the place to go. And look, when you see a joint finance operation like we've got with Trump 47 is what we're calling it this year, people can go to Trump 47 and be able to make the investments there. They're going to run through Win Red, and Win Red is going to give you a platform that you can trust to be able to make your small dollar donations to the RNC and to the presidential campaign.
Well, I hope you will keep coming back here, Michael, Notre Dame or not, UNC fan or not. But I do want to point out one thing. I hope I never see you on NBC or MSNBC. They're going to want you. They're going to beg you to come. And when they called Ron an election denier, they mean you, me, everyone who voted for Trump. That's what they meant, right?
Look, I think at the end of the day, we need to communicate across all platforms at all times. But right now, we just need to make sure that the American public is focused on the huge distinction, the huge contrast between Donald Trump and Joe Biden and Republicans and Democrats up and down the ballot.
Well, I hope you go back. Look at Reince's statement in 2014. It took about 1 week for Phil Griffin to bend the knee and apologize, because when the Republicans cut off a news network, I mean, cut them off, they realized they've just got to stop this MSNBC agitprop. I mean, like, it's newspeak from 1984. It's Brave New World. It's Darkness at Noon stuff, Michael. Did they read those at Notre Dame and Wake Forest and UNC? I'm just wondering.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I think, you know, we all know that the media is biased. We all know that they play with double standards. And you've got to be able to communicate to the American voters no matter how they do. And that's the beauty of what Donald Trump has been able to do and what other candidates have been able to do. If you go through the media, if you go around the media, you go over the media, whatever vehicle you can find to get your message out to the American voters, because when they're informed voters, they're going to vote Republican.
RNC Chair Michael Whatley, thank you. Keep coming back, Notre Dame affiliation or not. I appreciate it. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back.
Thanks,
on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Thank you, Michael. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined now by Dr. Michael Oren, former Israeli ambassador to the United States. Good morning, Dr. Oren. Welcome. Good to have you back.
Always good to be with you.
I want to begin with a story in The Telegraph this morning from Great Britain. Israel admits, is the headline. Israel admits it may not be able to destroy Hamas now that U.S. has turned its back. Later in the article, it says that Israel's basically giving up and we're not going to win. We're not going to get these people. I think it's nonsense, but what do you say?
I say, as they say in Yiddish, malarkey. Malarkey. They keep planting these stories, Hugh. They keep planting the stories that the IDF isn't winning, that the IDF has failed. It's phased, you know, close to 6 months. It hasn't won yet. They pop up all over the place. Yesterday, we had a conversation with an extraordinary young gentleman named John Spencer from West Point, who's the world's expert on urban warfare. And he says, not only is the IDF succeeding, it's succeeding beyond anybody's expectations. We heard from the Israeli generals that the IDF has exceeded beyond its own expectations, and that we have every intention of going into Rafah, and that we're going to win the war.
All right. Now let me turn to part two.
They're planted.
New York Times this morning. Yes. Israel and Hezbollah trade fire with death reported on both sides. I hate that headline because Israel does not do anything except return fire. And if the Hezbollah would comply with UN Security Council resolution, 1701, they would be behind the Hani River, the Litani River, and there would be no war. But it looks like there's going to be a war in the north. What do you think?
Well, failing U.S. diplomatic efforts. And I said before, the diplomatic effort, and it's kind of, it gets a little arcane, is to impose retroactively U.N. Resolution 1701 from 2006. It was the handiwork of Condoleezza Rice. And it called for Hezbollah to withdraw its forces 20 miles from our border, north of the Litani River, and to have then a neutral force enter enforce the redundancy, a DZ, a demilitarized zone. Initially, it was supposed to be UNIFIL. UNIFIL turned out to be a complete failure. And now they're talking about putting the Lebanese army in there. Now, we have two problems with this. One is the United States believes there's actually a country called Lebanon. We don't. We think there's a company called Hezbollah. And the United States believes there's an entity known as the Lebanese army. We don't. We think it's Hezbollah. And so you're going to have Hezbollah guarding Hezbollah, right? You know, chicken and what's it, foxes and hen houses here. And then the question is, does the United States have any leverage that's going to get Hezbollah to retreat under Israeli fire away from the border at a time when Sunni terrorists are fighting Israel in the south? I don't see that happening. And then Israel's going to be faced with a number of difficult questions. Can we hold off a situation where the entire northern part of the country is uninhabitable, where Hezbollah is firing rockets at a far greater rate at us than Hamas did, and they're bigger rockets, more accurate rockets? And can we risk a situation where Hamas starts a war against us? How about Hezbollah starts a war against us? Very, very difficult situation in the north.
So what do you think is going to happen?
I think eventually we're going to have to deal with it one way or the other. No one's going to go back and live in these border communities, not in Matula, not in Kiryat Shmona. You wouldn't send your kids or grandkids to live there. And Hezbollah's right on the other side of the border. You can almost touch him to the fence. And it's an untenable, intolerable situation for any sovereign country.
Now, I saw Guy Benson this week at Fox News, and I talked to Mary Catherine Hamm. They're just back from Israel, and Guy went down to the kibbutzim, which were attacked, and to the Nova Festival. It's very shocking and sad. But he said what's eerie and spooky is the north, because there's nobody there except soldiers, and he doesn't think it's tenable.
But it isn't. But it isn't. And Hezbollah is keeping half of the IDF bogged down up there. They're getting shot at. I got neighbors up there. They're getting shot at every day.
There was a first Lebanon war. There was a second Lebanon war. Both of them involved ground incursions. Is that what you expect will happen? I think the American public needs to know. This is going to go on until 2025 on both ends, because this is just going to take being very methodical, very careful, being setting a new level for the rules of war. Israel is doing all that. But it's going to take another 6 to 10 months, don't you think?
It's a different war.
Right.
It's a different war. No. Gaza is going literally street to street, house to house, alley to alley, and then underground to the 400 miles of tunnels that Hamas has dug under the city, under Gaza. In southern Lebanon, there are 200 villages under which Hezbollah has stashed between 150 and 170,000 rockets. The estimate of the IDF for the daily rocket fire will be between 2,000 and 6,000 rockets a day. That means in 2 days, Hezbollah will surpass all the rockets fired by Hamas at Israel. Now, there's no system we have, not Iron Dome, not David Sling, that can withstand that type of onslaught. We're going to have to move our army fast, and I mean on the first day. None of this, a couple of weeks of bombing from the air. Move our army fast to go village to village, house to house, and neutralize those rockets. And it's not going to be like Gaza. The civilian population is going to try to run away. Hezbollah is going to try to stop them because, like Hamas, Hezbollah wants civilians to die. So the world will accuse us of being war criminals. But we're going to declare war against Lebanon, not just against Hezbollah. And it's going to be state to state warfare. It's going to be very different. And
I want Americans to hear that. And I'm going to continue to talk with Ambassador Oren off air and play it later in the program, put it in the podcast as well. So don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back at the top of the hour. During the break, I'll continue the conversation with Dr. Oren about Bibi Netanyahu and the government that is the government, no matter what anyone tells you. A rainy, cold, and wet Beltway on Holy Thursday. I hope you are enjoying a holiday tomorrow, Good Friday. I will not be on. I will be replaying an interview I did with Archbishop Charles Chaput, retired of Philadelphia, as well as a new Hillsdale Dialogue. Have a wonderful Easter. I'm joined now by Noah Rothman, senior political writer for National Review. Good morning, Noah. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. I'm very well. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Noah, I want to read to you what I tweeted last night. One of my go-to ways to fall asleep, you know, if it's noisy and the airplanes are flying over Reagan, is to turn on and listen to any random volume of Will and Ariel Durant's, you know, bazillion volume history of civilization, because it's really good. And it doesn't matter if you fall asleep in the middle of it, it'll turn off eventually and you can go back to it. But last night I had to actually stop and take up to Twitter and tweet this out, a quote, 44 times his patrician enemies tried to destroy him by indictment. 44 times Cato the Elder was saved by the votes of farmers who, like him, resented the venality and, in essence, lawfare. Will Durant, The History of Civilization, Volume 7, Caesar and Christ. What do you think of that? Cato the Elder indicted 44 times.
Yeah, I'd have to go way back to my high school Latin to recall the contextual analysis that you're summoning up here. I suppose, you could talk, you know, the Catiline conspiracy in Cicero and the allusions to the classics. That would appeal to the founders, certainly. And they would recognize, I think, probably the allusion that you're making here insofar as it represents.
No, Cato the Elder is 100 years before that, though, Noah. That's 100 years before the second Cato.
The post hoc effort to buy political authorities to use the mechanisms of government to affect political ends and torment their enemies. One of the discussions underway when they were talking about impeachment and in the Constitutional Convention and in the Federalist Papers, shifting the conditions for impeachment away from maladministration towards crimes and misdemeanors, because maladministration could be abused by subsequent governments to criminalize retroactively politics, essentially. So the founders would have been familiar with, I think, the allusion that you're drawing up there. And so would the British, and so would the Americans and the early Republic. So it's certainly not outside the realm of our political experience.
No, and in fact, it's ongoing, and now it's spreading out, which leads me to Ronna McDaniel. Now, Ronna is my friend, and I used to work for NBC, and I participated with NBC in the debate that I moderated with Lester and Kristen in November. What they did to Ronna was shameful, disgraceful, and a public shaming and slamming for which they will inevitably be sued, and there will be a settlement, and we won't know about it. My question is, do you know of anyone on NBC or MSNBC who actually likes Trump and speaks well of Trump?
I don't know if I know anybody in media.
I do. Likes I will. Trump. I'm going to vote for him. Trump. I'm going to vote for him. 100% well, I'm going to vote for him.
I don't know anybody who's not overtly conservative, who's an opinion journalist. On the neutral objective side, objectivity is an ideal that is very rarely achieved, if it is sought at all. You and I have friends over at that network. I predicted on the editor's podcast at National Review, not hours before she would let go, that she would probably survive. Why? Because the trajectory, first of all, this freakout looked a lot like what happened to Mick Mulvaney when he went over to CBS. There was this outpouring of hostility to the notion that anybody who participated in the Trump administration should be welcomed back into public life like he was. But he survived. And why? Because A, he was kind of milquetoast. He was on a bit of an apology tour. And he was one of the rare linkages to a political faction that is dominant on the right, which constitutes half the country. Now, after Donald Trump was elected in 2016, there was this big freakout in the press. How did this happen? How did we miss it? It's when they started parachuting journalists into diners in West Virginia and Ohio to try to take the temperature of a nation they had largely ignored and simply didn't understand. And they've since overcome that professional obligation, subordinated it to what we've seen over the last 24 hours at that network, where I still have many friends, a very emotive display, and they're doing it again.
No, I've got a lot of friends there, too. I worked for him for 4 years, and I love Lester and Kristen. I worked well with Caesar and Rebecca and Carrie, all that gang. We did 12 dress rehearsals. I spent 2 weeks with them. I didn't think they'd lose their mind. They lost their mind, and they let. This is what I don't understand. I'd like your observation. If you began to beat up on Jack Butler, who is eminently abusable. He was my intern forever, and his father was my law school roommate. So we could just kick Jack Butler around forever. Don't you think Rich Lowry would call you up and say, Noah, stop that. He's your colleague. You're creating a hostile work environment, and Jack's going to sue us.
Possibly, but it would have to take a long time. The guy can take a lot of abuse. But you're right. Intercollegial relationships like that should be fostered. One of the things that we heard from, I think it was Cesar Conde's memo after Rona was let go, is that the newsroom needs to be united. The newsroom doesn't need to be united.
Never.
They don't need to be of the same mind.
That's the worst idea. They do need to be professional. Right. Explain what that's it means different. To be professional. That's what I told people about NBC.
Well, not impugning the character. Not impugning her character, her motives, her humanity. She's been alleged on air to be part of a conspiracy to overthrow the United States government.
Rachel called her a mobster and a pickpocket. It's a lie.
I mean, these are very serious allegations. Do they rise to the level of slander? I don't know. But are they attacks on her character and her professional comportment? Yes, in ways that I think are deeply unprofessional.
It's very hard to defame a public figure. You have to be recklessly disregarding the truth or knowingly perpetrating a falsehood that causes damage. I taught torts. I know all that. I think they actually succeeded in clearing that bar because the hostile workplace. Now, here's my question. Do you think any Republican ought to go on that network? Because I don't. I think they owe Ronna McDaniel an apology. I don't think they've given her one. I don't think they fired her, by the way. I'm reading every account very closely. They say she's not going to appear. I don't think they fired Ronna. I don't think they can.
Yeah, they may have to. From what I heard, they may have to pay out her contract. So I'm not sure that the thought here among those who are even a little bit concerned about this, who are journalists who are allied with NBC, is that, you know, we need sources. We need somebody we can talk to inside the Republican Party, you know, political establishment here. How else are we going to do our jobs? And the same day they got rid of Ronna McDaniel, they dropped this big interview with RNC co-chair Laura Trump alongside Garrett Hawk, reporter over at NBC News. That's pretty fortuitous and probably just coincidental.
I bet it's coincidental.
May ease fears. Well, it is, but it'll ease fears within the organization that they need us as much as we need them.
It shouldn't.
It'll take a little bit of time to see. Well, it'll take a little bit of time to see if Republicans actually do decide, well, we got to boycott this network, at which point there will be a crisis of conscience inside the network, but not until.
Boycott is something I don't do, but I will choose not to watch. I never watch MSNBC because I don't want to be crazy, but I used to watch NBC News and I used to watch Meet the Press and I used to be on Meet the Press and I'm just done with them. And Comcast owns NBC and they told, I said this to Martha McCollum yesterday, the message to me is we do not want you to watch our network. You're a Republican. You voted for Trump in 16 and 20. You intend to vote for him in 24. We don't want you to watch our network. That's their message. Am I wrong, Noah?
It's so strange. I don't know. I mean, that's the impression that is being conveyed. That's a suicidal impression for a television network to want to project. You know, I don't know the truth of this, but when I was taken on as a contributor, I was an MSNBC contributor for 3 years, something like that, 2018 to 2020.
It's like a prison sentence. I know. You were. You came after.
No, it's not. It's not. I have a lot of friends on that network. I really enjoyed my time on there. And I spent a lot of it articulating a conservative point of view, a principle that the audience hated. Every time I was on, I was bombarded with attacks. Nobody who watched that network who took the time to write to me liked my appearance. Now, when I saw people in real life, they did.
But exactly my experience. No, what I mean to say is that a Republican or a conservative on that network, and now on NBC, is either a missionary or a refugee. And they try and pretend that they're refugees or actually missionaries. You were a missionary. I was a missionary. We all get killed in the end. And by a jail sentence, I mean, you got to show up when they want you to. You have to go.
Of course. And I did gladfully. And I enjoyed my time on that network. And I'm very grateful to that network and its hosts still to this day. However, what I understood to be the project under Andy Lack, the previous.
Under Andy Lack.
Was that the network was trying to build up a stable of conservatives who were not necessarily Trump fans. Indeed, most of us were Trump skeptics, remain so. But people like Brett Stevens, myself. The idea was to get a line into this point of view within the Republican Party that they were trying to cultivate And when the post-Trump era emerged, they would be well-positioned to capitalize on that.
Noah, can you stick around for one more segment? I got to go to break. Can you stick around for five more minutes?
Sure.
All right. Don't go anywhere. I'll be back with Noah right after these messages. Stay tuned, America. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I'm joined by Noah Rothman, senior political writer for National Review, and like me, an alum of MSNBC. Although, Noah, I've got the ace in the hole. I have the lowest rated show in the history of MSNBC on my side. Ronan disputes that, but I actually I have the lowest rate because they put it on Saturday morning at 7:30 after the American Express infomercial. Noah, there are 74 million people who voted for Donald Trump in 2020. He won in 2016. At the debate, at a quiet moment, I talked to an NBC colleague, and there are about 40 people working on this thing. Said, how many people in this room do you think voted for Donald Trump? Dead silence. I said, one, me. There are 40 people in this room. One of us voted for Donald Trump. And it's not because I approve of everything he does or disapprove of it. It's because you elect a party and you elect 3,000 people. How hard is it to find a person who will simply say, I voted for Trump twice. I'm going to vote for him again and put him on NBC. It isn't that hard. Why won't they do it?
Well, because the network is trying to attempt to promote an ideological trajectory within the Republican Party, or at least was, and is now attempting to anathemize the Republican Party. At least that's the ideological goal. There's a news side, there's an opinion side. You know that. Most, I think, viewers, educated, media literate voters or viewers would know that. On the ideological side, the opinion side, they have an objective, and it is very hostile to the existence of this particular ideological trajectory that the GOP is on. The news side, however, they do have an obligation to at least cultivate sources. And cultivating sources means maintaining good relationships, and maintaining good relationships means not alienating people with things that have, like what happened to Ron McDaniel. So the ideological side and the news side do conflict in a way that is detrimental to the bottom line of the business, not just the red and the black, but what it's designed to do, inform the American people. That's the prime directive. And if the ideological side and the news side do conflict in a way that is really seriously detrimental to the mission, then the network's brass really does have to think about reining in the talent.
This is a teardown.
Not telling people what to say, but telling people to adopt an approach that is less hostile in a way that will that'll threaten their access to sources.
And here's my theory. I just want you. This is a teardown project. Some people buy houses and tear them down because they cannot be remodeled. You cannot remodel NBC News into a news organization. You cannot remodel MSNBC, which it took Orwell's 3 minutes of hate and turned it into 24/7, 365 of hate. Anathematize is a good word. But do you think they'll ever do that? Will anyone do it? Because I look around at the big legacy media networks. None of them have any serious Republicans who voted. I mean, people voted for Reagan and Bush and Trump. People who are Republican. There aren't any.
Well, Hugh, they did. I mean, you and I are not that old. We're old enough to remember 2012.
Yeah.
We're old enough to remember 2012. When the network adopted the Lean Forward moniker, it positioned itself as this very progressive FDR-style network promoting that ideology and advancing the Obama agenda and turning Mitt Romney into a caricature and a racist was a project of that network. That's when we talked about, you know, code words, and we decided that Mitt Romney was secretly attempting to activate a white nationalist base by saying things like apartment and Chicago and Constitution. This is real stuff. You can look it all up. I was at Mediaite at the time. I was tasked with chronicling what was said on this network on a minute-to-minute basis. I don't think I had a lot of good relationships over there when I was taken on in 2018, 2017. They did restyle themselves in order to adapt to the new political environment. They can do it again. Absolutely.
They tried with Andy Lack. And then Andy made a big deal about it.
And a willingness to alienate some of the audience.
It's the 1%, the real 1%. Is the 1% that watches MSNBC, and they're allowing it to ruin their network. I mean, ruin it.
Who tweeted
them? Last word to you.
Who tweeted them? Yeah, it's the people who they hear from who are the least representative of the broader spectrum of viewers who they're trying to attract, who tweeted them, who write emails to them, who are the most engaged, who watch this network not to be informed, but for fun, to be entertained, and to have what they believe retailed back to them. That is who they're hearing from primarily, and that's what's shifting their coverage. And that, as you said, is a vastly underrepresentative sample of the A, their own viewers, and B, the broader universe of cable news viewers that they need to attract. So it can't be done.
Well said.
It just takes will.
Well said, Noah. And NBC, which is not a cable station, they're dead to me, and they should be dead to every Republican. I don't know what they do to resurrect themselves. It's Easter. We'll see. Noah Rothman, have a great weekend. Thank you. Josh Krosshauer is the editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider. Josh, good morning. I talked to Ambassador Oren earlier today. He's arriving in D.C. for a undisclosed diplomatic mission. Any reporting on that? What's going on? Are the Israelis trying to get the United States back on the balance beam?
So I don't know about former Ambassador Oren's visit, but I do know that Ron Dermer, one of Bibi's closest political advisors, he's got a portfolio in the Israeli cabinet, is got a meeting back on with the White House. And much, if not all of that discussion, Hugh, is going to be about any plans for an invasion or an operation in Rafah. So that is a lot of this posturing, a lot of the political fights, Hugh, over the past couple of weeks have really been about getting to some consensus, getting the Americans to buy into some operation in Rafah and getting them to understand from the Israeli perspective that Hamas needs to be defeated. It needs to be routed in its final stronghold for this war to be won.
Josh, the vice president has studied the map, right? So she says it can't be done. Everybody I talk to in Israel, from the left to the right and in between, and everyone I listen to, and I try and get a lot, they all say we're going into Rafah. And then, by the way, there's going to be a war in the north. Is that the consensus left, center, and right opinion?
Well, look, those are two separate things. There's a lot of worry in Israel about the northern front. It actually heating up in the last 24 hours with Hezbollah firing rockets and a lot of skirmishes in that northern border. And I think people don't appreciate in the United States, you have, I think, about 100,000 Israelis in the north that can't live in their homes because of the threat that Hezbollah poses. So there is... You know, the U.S. has been trying to reach some kind of diplomatic agreement with Hezbollah. It has not worked out, unsurprisingly, but there's going to be a time for the North to probably get more focus. But, you know, as far as Rafah goes, you see mixed messages. You've been talking about it on the show, Hugh. The White House has been all over the map. Kamala Harris said she saw a map, and that means they can't do the operation on ABC News this past weekend. But you actually saw a story in the Wall Street Journal that actually shows that the U.S. is actually working with the Israelis, and they think that there actually can be some kind of operation that takes place and evacuates the many Palestinian civilians that are holed up in around that area. So, look, I think a lot of this, and we've talked about this so much on the show, Hugh, is about domestic American politics, support for, you know, people see the devastating images, the humanitarian concerns in Gaza. It's had a toll in terms of public support in this country, especially among Democrats, for Israel's military efforts in Gaza. The base of the Democratic Party is turning on Biden, is turning on the party, and they're getting closer to the November elections. So, you know, there's a real political concern. It's why Schumer gave the speech he did a couple weeks ago. It's why Biden and certain anonymous officials have been saying these things, saying that, you know, it can't be done, or, you know, the humanitarian concession can't really be realistically arranged. But you're also seeing a lot of mixed messages, a lot of trying to play both sides of this issue. And ultimately, you listen to the Israelis, they said they're going to go into Rafah. They need to defeat Hamas. That's part of the mission. And the U.S. has expressed public support for that part of the mission, defeating Hamas and taking them out of power in Gaza.
My last question, Josh. Do your readers want to know why the president and the vice president have not given a major address on anti-Semitism in the United States? Because it is now dangerous for American Jews on college campuses. I can't believe I would ever say that, but it is. Do you expect the president or the vice president or both to address this?
I will say this, Hugh, that I was surprised that in the president's State of the Union, that anti-Semitism did not get a mention. We have a reporter that covers just campuses, campus anti-Semitism full time at Jewish Insider. And it's a beat. I never thought it was going to be, you know, before October 7th, a beat that you literally would be getting reporting from dozens of schools on a daily basis of just harassment, assault, vandalism. It's pretty scary out there if you're a college kid, especially. And there's a generational gap. I think people under the age of 30 are the ones really bearing the brunt of this surge in anti-Semitism, and it's coming from the sort of radical left elements in the country. Look, I think it would be morally wise and important to do. There was a one thing we're looking at today, Hugh, is it was a city council meeting in San Francisco in the Bay Area, where which had nothing to do with Israel. It had to do with I believe it was like Holocaust Remembrance Day, and you had some of the most vile anti-Semitic slurs, harassment, some of the things I never would have thought could take place in the United States and America in the deep blue confines of San Francisco in the Bay Area.
John, we don't have enough time for this, but is it changing the political direction of the American Jewish community in any significant way?
It is. There's a divide in the Democratic Party, as you well know, Hugh. And in fact, one of the top Jewish Democratic groups today endorsed primary challengers to both Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush, two members of the squad that have been anti-Israel and have entertained Semitic conspiracy theories. So that's a big moment. That's a big moment. They're in political trouble, and it's taking place within the Democratic. It's not taking place Republican. It's taking place within the Democratic Party, where you have more moderate or at least more mainstream candidates emerging in some of these primary races.
Breaking the news, as always, Josh Kroshauer. Follow him on X at Josh Kroshauer. Follow him at Jewish Insider. Except over to Alliance Defending Freedom banner at the top of HughHewitt.com. Alliance Defending Freedom has got a Supreme Court argument next week. They win. Typically at the Supreme Court, they've won 15 times in the last two decades, 15 times. Takes about $1 million to win one of those cases. I just urge you, whether it's $5, $50, $500, Alliance Defending Freedom, it's completely tax deductible. They preserve your rights in a court, at least part of which is hostile to your First Amendment rights to free speech and the free exercise of your faith. So please support Alliance Defending Freedom. The banner is at HughHewitt.com. At the top, you cannot miss it. Stay tuned. Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
Sure tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is. But we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that, because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is and it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's
864-644-1900.
Joined now by the poet laureate of the Hugh Hewitt Show, Tarzana Joe. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Hugh. A poem for the week, I think. On a Sunday triumphant, they gave us the word. Every year in the springtime, the story is heard. When we're given a chance with all of our breath to sing his hosannas, then cry for his death. How quick on that Monday the spirit was burning. Zeal for his house and the tables were turning. Tuesday a crowd, and he spoke to them all, explaining again how the temple would fall. Then Wednesday at Bethany, preparing for trial, did he know there were planning, betrayal, denial? A Thursday so holy, at dinner and prayer, when he gave us the bread that he told us to share. Friday of darkness, despairing and doubt, when those that he led thought the light had gone out. To a day with just sorrow, to fear and to grieve, not knowing at all what to fear or believe. How the mighty have fallen. But what a surprise, at the close of the week, how the mighty arise. That's A Holy Week by Tarzana Joe.
That's an amazing poem, Joe. That's really brilliant.
I thought you'd like
how long did you work on that?
I thought you'd like preparing for trial as part of the things that went on.
I just think that is inspired, because Holy Week is a concept genuinely lost in the culture. Now, if it came out of Catholic culture in the 60s, it was a big deal. Every day had a deal. And I think it's genuinely gone now. How long did that take? That's a brilliant piece of work.
Oh, thank you. This is probably my most revised poem I've ever written. Every word was changed and crossed out and done again.
It shows. It's just brilliant. That is already posted, I hope, at TarzanaJoe.com, because a whole lot of pastors and a whole lot of preachers are going to grab that for their Sunday sermons.
I hope so. Yes, it will be there at TarzanaJoe.com.
And if you want to get in touch with Joe, I can't guarantee he's going to produce something like that, but something almost as good. TarzanaJoe@Reagan.com. You know, people need to get ready for weddings. They need to get ready for retirements. TarzanaJoe@Reagan.com. Get a poem. Don't trust yourself to be the author in chief. Trust Joe. Hey, Joe, happy Easter to you. Sunday's coming.
Happy Easter.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.